Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about protecting wildlife in Cambodia with Suwana Gauntlett, co-founder and executive director of Wildlife Alliance. Wildlife Alliance is a nonprofit organization based in Cambodia and Washington, D.C. It works directly with communities and governments to improve forest management and institute good governance to comprehensively address the devastation of ecosystems and also to combat the illegal wildlife trade. Much of what it does focuses on empowering local communities by promoting diversified agriculture, community-based ecotourism, and reforestation. Suwana Gauntlett has dedicated her life to protecting rainforest and wildlife in some of the world's most hostile and rugged environments. And she's also set the trend of a new generation of direct action conservationists. She has designed, implemented, and supported bold frontline conservation programs to save endangered wildlife populations from the brink of extinction, including saving the Amur tiger, also known as Siberian tiger, from extinction in the 1990s in the Russian Far East, when only about 80 individuals remained, and reversing the drastic decline of Olive Ridley sea turtles along the coast of Orissa, India, in the 1990s when annual nestings had declined from 600,000 to a mere 8,130. When she first arrived in Cambodia in the late 1990s, its forests were silent. You couldn't hear any birds, you couldn't hear any wildlife, and you could hardly see any signs of wildlife because of the destruction, Gauntlett said. Wildlife was being sold everywhere, in restaurants, on the street, and even her local beauty parlor had a bear. In fact, Cambodia has long been one of Asia's five main source countries for wildlife exported for traditional Asian medicine, exotic pets, and meats. While laws protecting species and prohibiting their sale were on the books, they were never enforced. But that's changing. In just 10 years, Suwana and Wildlife Alliance have worked hard with Cambodia's government to reduce the illegal wildlife trade, with great success. As Suwana says in this interview, "We've repressed the wildlife trade by 70%. Now, like in Prohibition time in the United States, people have to go into closed bars. They have to hide to eat wildlife." Her work with Wildlife Alliance also focuses on protecting habitats in Cambodia and elsewhere. Suwana likens Cambodia's challenges to the movie Avatar and notes that the biggest threat to wildlife is clear-cutting of its tropical forests for commerce. The stories are similar around the world. In Brazil, for example, forests are cleared for soya and livestock. In Indonesia, it's for palm oil and rubber. This reality has prompted Suwana and Wildlife Alliance to focus on fighting these forest conversions and instead providing alternative and more diversified and sustainable means of making a living. Already, she and Wildlife Alliance have helped convince the government to avoid 28 economic land concessions and saved over 2 million acres of forest land. One of those that Suwana talks about in today's interview are her efforts in the southern Cardamom Mountain Range, one of Asia's last seven elephant quarters and Cambodia's largest remaining intact forest. The Cardamom Mountains are a unique landscape. It's the largest watershed in the region, with 20 major waterways that feed 3,800 villages in over six provinces. Already, her program has reduced elephant poaching there by 95%, tiger poaching by 50%, and forest fires by 80%. However, those successes are now under threat due to the recent approval of a land concession for a proposed titanium mine. For Suwana, that approval is a travesty because, as she notes, without scientific research to prove the economic viability of the proposed mine, bulldozing the rainforest is simply destructive and does not even make good business sense. When we spoke in late January 2011, I started by asking Suwana to tell me about Wildlife Alliance.
Initially, it was Global Survival Network, and then in 1999, the amount of founding directors has fluctuated, and in 1999, we were four directors coming together, all with our own field programs, and we called it WildAid. And We had programs in the Galapagos, in India, Siberia, Thailand, Myanmar. And then this became Wild Aid. We became kind of at the forefront of direct protection to forests and wildlife. And we've continued that. In 2005, we then kind of divided into two different organizations. One is still called Wild Aid today. They're based in San Francisco. And we're called Wildlife Alliance, based in Washington, D.C. Wild Aid we're both focused on the wildlife trade. And Wild Aid is focused on stopping the consumption. And so doing a lot of advertisements and public campaigns with the theme, when the buying stops, the killing can too. And there are quite a lot of champions and athletes and actors that are doing PSAs for that education campaign, not only in the U.S., but also in China, Taiwan, and India. Whereas what we do, Wildlife Alliance, is focused on the field. We stop the wildlife trade at the source in protected areas, and we have with the government a special brigade that goes throughout the country of Cambodia and stops illegal shipments that are going to neighboring countries. Then we rescue these animals and we give them a chance either to be rehabilitated back into the wild, or if they are too young and or they are wounded, they stay in a rescue center and we give them the best care and wildlife, like natural habitat for their environment. So that's kind of the history.
You've had some major successes throughout the short life of the organization. Can you talk about some of those?
Yes, certainly. I just want to say that in terms of our global work, what we focus on is, bottom line, saving a species, stopping deforestation. We're not focused on research. We do research as well, but we're focused on results, which means our approach, our point of view, our angle is that there's been so much research in the conservation field, and wild species were being studied, that they are also going extinct. One good example is the Indo-Chinese tiger. We know that tigers in the world now, the numbers have dropped to an all-time low of an estimated 3,500. We know for a fact that the Indo-Chinese tiger has only a few hundred left, and this is Southeast Asia. So while we've studied these animals and not taken direct action, these animals are on the brink of extinction. This is happening in Cambodia. I've witnessed it personally. There's massive genocide of animals that are being exported to neighboring countries, are being used in restaurants and for pets inside the country.
Tell me about what happened when you arrived in Cambodia. When did you arrive and what was it like at that point in time?
I arrived in Cambodia in the year 2000, and the reason that we came to Cambodia is because we had programs in Burma and in Thailand, and we were waiting for the end of the civil war in Cambodia, which is we knew had very rich biodiversity and very large forest cover. I arrived in 2000 and I was appalled because I saw wildlife trade everywhere. Wild animals being sold in markets, in people's homes, on the sidewalks, in restaurants. You'd go to the bathroom and you would see turtles and pangolins in nets waiting to be boiled. On the roof there would be long-tailed macaques, which are monkeys, waiting for their brains to be eaten alive. In the back of restaurants you would see bears waiting for their next paw to be cut off to be eaten after, you know, after golf tournaments as a delicatessen. You'd be invited at a general's home. He'd have tigers and bears in his garden in tiny cages. I remember there was a beauty parlor where young ladies used to go, and I used to buy some beauty products. And upstairs, there was a bear in a cage.
Really?
In the hallway.
For what and purpose?
It is a completely different mentality. If you have a powerful wild animal, it's a sign of status. That means that you are more powerful than that animal, and that means you have money. So showing your friends a tiger or a bear in a cage means that you are you've really made it and you're high up in the this you have high status. What I did is it's a long story, but I worked with the Forestry Administration, who were very willing to take a stance on this. They already had a law, but it wasn't being enforced. And I helped them create the first brigade in Southeast Asia on law enforcement with the Forestry Administration and military police to go around the country and crack down on all the illegal wildlife trade, shipments to neighboring countries, restaurants, markets. So we would do undercover investigations, inspections, crackdown. We cracked down on thousands of restaurants. I was lucky enough to get the Prime Minister on board, who gave orders to all the law enforcement agencies to stop the wildlife trade. The mayor of Phnom Penh created new regulations and talked about it every morning on his five-minute radio show, threatening to close restaurants if they didn't stop selling wildlife. And he followed up and closed the biggest restaurant in town.
Really?
And this goes on. Yes. And today you will not find in Phnom Penh wildlife for sale, at least visible. You can sometimes order it if you call it in advance. It's not on menus. Everybody knows it's illegal.
That's quite a change.
Oh, it was. We did it in a couple of years. Of course, one brigade is not enough to stop the entire wildlife trade crossing the borders, but it gives... It sets the pace, gives the message, shows that the government is serious in enforcing the laws.
So tell me more about this brigade. How big is it, and what really led to its success? It sounded like having support from high level was really important.
Yes, having support from high level was really important. The brigade is 14 men, 4 foresters, and 10 military police. And one Wildlife Alliance advisor that goes on patrols with the team. We are formally, Wildlife Alliance is the project manager of this brigade, which is called Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team.
Does it cover the whole country, or does it focus more on cities?
It focuses on the whole country. And at some point in 2005, 2006, we had support from the U.S. government to focus, because we had a great success in Phnom Penh, and they asked us if we could replicate it in 5 other cities, so we did. And we did a combination of education and law enforcement. But the brigade is working throughout the 23 provinces.
That sounds still like a huge amount of land to cover for 14 people.
It is, and sometimes they have to break up into 3 groups, and we have a lot of people calling and saying, we'd like to donate the bear that we have. We realize it was not a good idea to keep this bear in a cage, so the team is really split, very thin. Unfortunately, this is the only brigade that exists, and it's already expensive to operate.
So how is it funded?
The Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team is funded through a variety of organizations, SeaWorld, Busch Garden, Disney World, some private donors. This year we were funded by CEPF, which is the Critical Environmental Path Fund. Unfortunately, that fund closes formally this year, and individual donors from the website. I have to say that it's been our most popular program, along with the wildlife care.
And I have a separate program with Nick Marks on the wildlife care.
How much success has the Wildlife Rapid Rescue Team had in stopping illegal trade? I mean, now you're not seeing it openly.
Right. I think what we say is we've repressed the wildlife trade by 70%, and it's pretty much like prohibition time in the United States, in Chicago, when people had to go into closed bars to drink. Here, you have to really hide to eat wildlife. It's still happening. The main endangered species, such as tigers, I'd say tigers mostly, and elephants, are no longer hunted, because tigers mostly are extinct. They're gone. Because of the wildlife trade, elephants are extremely protected, and if you want to sell an elephant, you can hardly do it in a hidden fashion. It's too visible, so that is not happening. However, smaller species such as sun bears, pangolins, are still being sold. I would say that we are deterring the wildlife trade nationally and probably at the 70% level.
And which are some of the species that, I mean, I've heard a lot about pangolins, particularly because a lot of organized networks are operating now vis-a-vis pangolins. Is that what you're seeing or not so much?
What we're seeing is that the larger, more charismatic species are going to extinction, so they aren't available in the forests anymore. And therefore, the traders are focusing on less charismatic species, which is now pangolins. Pangolins are at something like $200 per kilo, when they used to be at $45 a kilo, and 10 years ago they used to be at like $5 a kilo. They're becoming more and more rare. Slow lorises, we can hardly find anymore. Long-tail macaques are being sold for laboratories in Vietnam. So you have the more common species are being trafficked. Pangolin is now an endangered species. And by the way, we have the mobile unit, we still call it the mobile unit, WRRT, has confiscated over 40,000 live animals over the last 9 years. And this includes 5 metric tons of meat, 7 metric tons of body parts and specimens. So it's huge. A huge amount of wildlife has been confiscated. And the number of traders that have been arrested, I think it's something like 637 traders have been arrested.
What happens once they're arrested? Are they paying fines?
Yes.
Or going to jail?
Yes.
Or?
It depends on the law. If it's an endangered species that they are transporting, they face 5 to 10 years prison. And if it is a common species, they will be paying 3 times the value of this animal on the market. So, for example, pangolins, which are now $200 per kilo, if they have, you know, 3 pangolins that are worth 50 kilos, then you multiply 50 by 200. That's a sharp penalty, and their car is confiscated. The vehicle will only be returned if they pay the penalty. But, of course, the wildlife is never returned. If the animals are still alive and in good shape, they are kept to be rehydrated and fed for 48 hours and then released back into their natural habitat in an area that is protected properly. And if not, if they are wounded, they have to go to the rescue center until they are able to be returned to the wild.
We've talked a lot about wildlife, but a lot of your work is also related to the forest and the forest in which the wildlife live.
Yes.
What are some of the threats to the forest in Cambodia and elsewhere in Southeast Asia?
Well, as you know, the forest in Cambodia is part of the tropical belt. So we're in the same tropical climate and tropical biodiversity as Brazil, Indonesia, Thailand, Myanmar, Vietnam. And technically, Cambodia is in the Indo-Burmese Peninsula. And we are helping protect one of the world's 34 biodiversity hotspots, which is the Cardamom Mountain Range, and that's the largest remaining rainforest in Southeast Asia. This is also one of only 7 remaining elephant corridors in Asia.
Why is that?
Because of economic interests, most of the forests in Asia have been fragmented, which means that you have islands of forest, and then you have great spaces of development and another island of forest. Large species such as elephants and tigers need a continuous forest cover and a continuous range in order to reproduce and find enough food. Their species will be extinct if they are not able to move across large ranges of forest cover. So the biggest threat in Southeast Brazil and, of course, Cambodia is conversion of tropical forest to large-scale agriculture. In Brazil, it's soybean predominantly and livestock. In Indonesia, it's everything from palm oil to rubber to other types of high-yield crops. In Cambodia, it's also the same thing. It's rubber, it's sugar cane, it's palm oil. And our challenge has been, it's a little bit similar to Avatar. We're fighting these economic interests. from the grassroots level, and we've been successful so far in avoiding 28 economic land concessions, thus avoiding conversion of 607,000 hectares, which amounts to almost 2 million acres.
2 million acres of forest saved.
Yes.
What is an economic land concession, and how do you fight it?
An economic land concession is a permit from the government that allows a company, a large company such as agro-industry, palm oil, sugarcane, rubber, to clear-cut the forest, bulldoze all the trees away, and plant a commercial plantation instead. These permits cover thousands of hectares, typically 20,000 hectares, 30,000 hectares, and you multiply that by 2.3 for acres, so that's almost 100,000 acres right there. And sometimes these economic land concessions are for mining as well, or hydropower. How do we fight these? We fight them on two fronts. Sometimes the economic land concessions are legitimate, and they're from the government, and sometimes they aren't. The smaller cases will be maybe a military in a high position, trying to grab land on state forests, issues some kind of permit from a governor, local governor or district governor, which bears no legal weight whatsoever, but he tries to bully his way in and intimidates villagers and law enforcement officers and starts clearing with his own bulldozer. And if there's no close monitoring, he succeeds. And then after the fact, he has his plantations on site and nobody can do anything about it. But mostly, it's how we stop these economic land concessions that are legal are personal interactions between me, Suwana, and government officials.
How do you do that?
For all the economic land concessions that had valid permits or were going to have valid permits, I personally interact with the government. I act a little bit as a lawyer, if you will. I go on the ground, I document GIS points, do GIS mapping, take aerial photographs, and then build the case as to why that economic land concession should not be implemented in that specific location. I then correspond directly with the ministerial level, Council of Ministers, and sometimes the Prime Minister himself, and follow up with meetings, and then follow up correspondence. Sometimes if it's really necessary, I call upon a steering committee that was formed upon our request, which is an interministerial committee. I bring them to the site, I brief them, and they then go back to central government and represent the case. And that's usually how it's done, how I do it.
That is an unusual approach in some respects, because the government seems so open to hearing a broader story.
Please let me put this back into context. The economic land concession issue is relevant, I think, when an organization like ours, Wildlife Alliance, has been working in an area for several years. We have been assisting the government to implement the Cardamom Protection Program since 2002. And it's a give and take. We've helped the government put in place their ranger patrols. We conduct the aerial monitoring. We've helped and facilitated zoning and demarcation of 255 kilometers of forest, helped zone 5 communes and urban zones. We've been the developers of 3 communes' alternative livelihoods, which is sustainable agriculture and ecotourism, to help the farmers stop doing slash and burn, which is a very destructive cultivation method that destroys the rainforest. So having seen our partnership yield a lot of positive results, the government is also willing to be forthcoming in helping to continue to protect the area.
Can you describe the area? It sounds like the Cardamom Mountain Range and the rainforest in that area is extremely unique.
The Cardamoms are a unique landscape. First of all, they are one of the 34 hotspots for biodiversity on the planet, and they are the largest watershed in the region, providing a staggering rainfall of 3,000 to 4,000 millimeters of rain per year, with 20 major waterways feeding 3,800 villages in 350 communes over six provinces. They have the water coming from the cardamoms feeds the largest lake fisheries in Southeast Asia called Tonle Sap Lake on the northern side, and feeds 155 kilometers of mangrove fisheries in the Gulf of Thailand. So it's enormous. And that is why the government has chosen that that mountain range to produce electricity, and 16 hydropower dams are scheduled. In the area that we are responsible for, which is the southern portion, we are already working with seven hydropower dam companies to avoid unwanted deforestation through duplication and many other factors. But that is why this is a strategic rainforest for the region and for the government. It's a climate regulator, and it's also the only remaining unfragmented rainforest left in Southeast Asia. That's why it's one of seven remaining elephant corridors in Asia.
So it's useful not just for elephants, but a lot of species because it's unfragmented.
That's right, exactly. Exactly. So we have an enormous biodiversity. Just talking about plants, for example, when we did a scientific survey 4 years ago, we found over 2,000 plants that have no name, that have not been cataloged scientifically in just 4 months. And in terms of species,
2,000 plants uncataloged.
2,000 uncataloged species of plants.
Wow.
It's enormous.
And how about animals?
Most of the charismatic species of the cardamoms are globally endangered and globally threatened. They range from Asian elephant to Indochinese tiger, Malayan sun bear, Asiatic black bear, southern sarrow, pangolin. We have Irrawaddy dolphins, humpback dolphins. It's an incredible biodiversity. Half of Cambodia's bird species, including black-necked storks, lesser adjutants, crested serpent eagles, hornbills, great hornbills, wreathed hornbills. It's a beautiful biodiversity, slow lorises, pileated gibbons, and so on.
Sounds stunning.
That's why it's so important to preserve it. It's really, from climatic to water to biodiversity, it is a treasure of the planet and must be preserved. It is pretty much like the Amazon in a smaller version.
Do a lot of people live there?
It is mostly unpopulated, but the reason that we are protecting the southern portion and not the northern portion is because that is the most populated area. And when a national highway was built in 2002 to link Cambodia to Thailand and gutted through 155 kilometers of rainforest, the government asked us for help because all along the road you had land grabbing for land speculation, forest fires every day. We had about 40 forest fires any given day, and 37 elephants and 12 tigers had been poached in just the year preceding the program. It was total anarchy and lawlessness. We came in, we helped the government set up some, on a shoestring, some small ranger stations, had a little pot of money to do some aerial surveys, and were able to stop 401 cases of land encroachment in just the first year of operations, helped the government create an interministerial steering committee to come and put pressure on local government in the province to stop selling state forests under the table. And in 1 year, everything was under control. We reduced forest fires to only 1 to 4 per week instead of 40 per day. Reduced elephant poaching by 98% and tiger poaching by 50%.
Wow. Now, you've also been working to halt a titanium mine in Cambodia with sort of a similar approach, it sounds like. Can you tell me about the mine? Where is it?
Our biggest challenge right now is this titanium mine that is located in the middle of the elephant corridor. It's north of Chipat. It is right in the middle of a thriving community ecotourism development that we have facilitated over the last 4 years.
How big is the proposed development?
The area is covers 20,400 hectares. So you multiply that by three, it's like 70,000 acres. It would be strip mined for titanium. The titanium's all on the surface.
And is titanium used for?
Titanium is used for airplanes, artificial hips, medical instruments, golf clubs.
Golf clubs. So it's a lightweight metal?
A lightweight, very, very hard, almost incompressible metal.
Who is proposing the mine? Is it a government mine or is it outside developers?
Who is proposing the mine is a Cambodian company, and it is the Ministry of Mines that is sponsoring them. This is what I call a typical case of uncoordinated development, whereby there has been no previous information sharing or planning between two different ministries, and this unfortunately happens in a lot of countries. So what we did is we went about getting these two ministries to talk to each other and rallied as many different ministries and departments as we possibly could to go on site and see the dense evergreen rainforest, the elephant corridor, and the ecotourism thriving businesses so as to not destroy everything that had already been accomplished. I personally accompanied two interministerial committees and the deputy prime minister on site, conducting aerial flights, going on the ground trekking, showing them the reasons, the economic achievements of the community ecotourism, and really building the case for why this is sustainable development. But if you bring in the mine and strip mine everything, it will be unsustainable. Everyone in the village will lose their jobs. Out of 550 families, we've been able to build already 360 jobs. The mine says they would offer up to 300 or 500 jobs. Well, why take away the jobs that already exist to just replace them with one single employer?
Can you describe the ecotourism that's going on now? You said there's 550 families that are benefiting.
Yes, Chipat, where we have helped develop this ecotourism, used to be the worst community of the whole Cardamoms. They're a previous logging company. When the logging companies left in the 90s, there was no more opportunity for jobs. So people, about 280 families, went into the forest and started doing slash and burn. Burning the forest and just planting rice with sticks. They had absolutely nothing, no buffaloes, no plowing equipment. And we call it the circle of destruction. Every year, each family would go further into the forest, cultivating each 1.5 hectare per year. Many agencies in the U.S. think this is sustainable forestry cultivation, but it's not, because it is not shifting circular agriculture, which is called Sweden. It's basically you destroy a plot of rainforest, the rains come, take off the topsoil, there's no more fertility, and the next year you have to just clear another plot of forest. It's very much like the migrant farmers in the Amazon. That is why we focused on Chipat. We were able to help develop sustainable agriculture for 75 families. And then, after a couple years, we found funding to start a 7-year ecotourism process in Chipat.
Where are you now?
We're already at the 4th year. And right now, ecotourism is supporting 180 families with a total cumulated revenue of $66,000 since the official opening for tourism, which was in October 2008, all the way to December of this year, 2010.
What is that in relative terms? I mean, how far does that money go?
Now, in Southeast Asia, $66,000 is a lot of money. It's not at all the same scale as in the U.S. Families get 80% from their own enterprises, which is either homestays or guest houses or tour guides. And then their committee, which is our community committee for ecotourism, keeps 20%. for equipment maintenance, buying more mountain bikes, more kayaks, retrofitting more homestays. Currently, there are 60 rooms, and we have about 30 tourists coming every day.
And who are the tourists? Are they from the region or from...
The tourists are mostly international tourists. That's thanks to Wildlife Alliance. We've done international marketing in South America, North America, and Europe and Australia. And we work with 6 tour operators. We've also reached out to international guides, travel guides such as Lonely Planet, Le Petit Routard in France, and to all the newspapers, Wall Street Journal, in the Nation, The Globe, etc. And Lonely Planet now is listing, they call it the Kokong Conservation Corridor, which is the Cardamoms, as one of the world's top 10 destinations.
Really?
And yes. We were very, very happy to have that. And in from 2008 to 2010, they also listed Chipat as the best community-based ecotourism in Cambodia.
Why
is that? Yeah. it's a combination of things. A lot of people, especially in Cambodia, think that because they have a piece of forest, they can do ecotourism. It's not true. It's like a cocktail. You have to have several ingredients, and you have to have a winning mix, if you will. The Cardamoms really has that winning mix. First of all, it is the largest remaining rainforest in Southeast Asia. Secondly, it is one of Asia's last 7 elephant corridors. Thirdly, it has 13 ancient archaeological sites that are post-Angkorian burial jars hidden in caves inside the mountains, which is very mysterious and attractive. We have a variety of sports that can be implemented, such as mountain trekking. It's very hilly, very mountainous, mountain trekking, river kayaking, bathing in waterfalls, and of course, wildlife viewing and wildlife photographing.
So this titanium mine is planned to be built right smack dab in the middle of that.
Yes, the what we've done is we've developed the whole province as an ecotourism destination, and Chipat is one of the 3 main destinations at this point. So the titanium mine would threaten the survival of Chipat, but would also threaten the survival of the tourism industry throughout the province.
And Chipat is just one of the 3.
Chipat is one of the 3.
How would it impact the province?
It would turn Chipat into an industrial village. It would ruin the waterways and pollute them, but it would also be that these heavy trucks would be traveling through Chipat and along the main scenic ecotourism road all day long with huge amounts of rock and making a lot of noise and destroying the landscape.
What do the villagers in Chipat and elsewhere think? What's their opinion?
The villagers in Chipat do not want this mine. They are very happy with the diversified economic approach that we have helped them develop. 75 families doing agriculture, creating produce, vegetables, fruits, chickens for the ecotourism industry. Then we have the ecotourism industry, and then we have also a thriving reforestation center for tropical reforestation, where tourists can buy what we call a carbon travel neutral plan, where they offset their travel CO2 emissions by planting or adopting a swath of forest and mostly replanting tropical forest.
How have the villagers expressed themselves to the government, and what kind of impact do they have on decisions?
Well, how we started, we briefed the villagers, especially the community-based ecotourism committee and the 150 members. Actually, it's 180 families have businesses, but it's only officially 150 members. And explaining that the mine would take out all the employment options and the small enterprises that they are managing right now, and would be replaced with employment by one single employer, which is the titanium mine. We also explained to them that jobs would not be guaranteed because it's mostly specialized heavy equipment drivers and manhandlers that would be hired. There's not a whole lot of digging and moving by individual workers. It's a lot of heavy equipment. And that their village would be transformed into an industrial hub. Consequently, the four village chiefs of the commune wrote a letter to the prime minister requesting that this mine not be implemented, and they went around and obtained over 700 signatures to stop the mine. In parallel to that, I personally have organized visits by central government to the site to hear the villagers' concerns, to see their businesses, and to understand the dilemma between small enterprises and a multi-sector economic approach versus a larger pot of money by a mine, but that would reduce the employment pool to only one employer and is not very sustainable over the long term. Once the mine is finished, the whole natural resource is destroyed and people are left as poor as before because they no longer have a job. If you go with ecotourism, agriculture, and reforestation, it's a leverage effect. All these sectors leverage upon each other, creating direct and indirect jobs that keep on increasing. And not only do the same jobs continue over long term, but they are multiplied because more and more tourists arrive, and it's a snowball effect.
And what's been the reaction in terms, by the central government? And do you still have this conflict between the Ministry of Mines and the Forestry Ministry?
We think there is no more conflict now between the Ministry of Forestry and the Ministry of Mines. I think they're talking to each other. They're now part of interministerial committees deciding on the issue. We've been invited to actually defend the case of the forest and ecotourism with the company in a interministerial meeting with 17 departments. And we think we have achieved a success because now the government informally has spoken to the company asking them to reduce the surface to 50 hectares versus 20,400 hectares. And we have made the case that the company did actually not do any exploration, and there is no proof that the quantity of titanium is enough to make the mine profitable. Therefore, it looks like the government is giving a permit now to the company to go in over 50 hectares and do exploration. One of the things that happened during this debate was that the company pretended that the whole mining area was only bare soil and bamboo. And we were able to demonstrate that it is not bare soil and bamboo, but it is dense evergreen rainforest. And the government saw that the mining company was lying. And we kind of nudged them in the direction of saying, we think this mining company is a cover-up for logging. And the government departments have clearly seen this.
After Suwana and I spoke, the Cambodian Prime Minister approved a 20,400-hectare land concession to United Khmer Group. The approval came ahead of a meeting that had been scheduled on February 11, 2011, at the Council for the Development of Cambodia that was meant to discuss the proposed mining project. In a press release, Suwana Gauntlett noted that this is Cambodia's natural heritage and it could all be eliminated by 20,400 hectares of strip mining. In the interview, Suwana went on to respond to my questions about the economics of this project, including the value of the logs on the area and the titanium.
Are the logs that valuable?
Yes. Yes, they are. There is quite a lot of luxury wood called crunyun. Crunyun currently is being sold at $20,000 per cubic meter. And a cubic meter is the size of half of your table, basically, if you take it from the top of the table down to the ground. It's a very small amount of wood for a lot of money.
So is this happening elsewhere where there's cover-ups for logging? What are the logging rules or permits? Is that allowed?
Well, fortunately for us, we have very good partnership with the Ministry of Forestry that is very concerned about this mine, does not want this mine, and hopes to not be overruled by the Ministry of Mines, because ultimately the decision will be taken above both ministries by the Council of Ministers. There are rules saying that a mine can only deforest and clear in the current annual surface of exploitation, and that clearing must be done by the Forestry Administration themselves. And, of course, Wildlife Alliance will be there to monitor. So there are a lot of rules. In other parts of the country, there's no monitoring, so there can be some irregularities. In this case, we think there wouldn't be. However, our first angle right now with the government is this company is not for real, and they would not be a profitable titanium mine company. They're just coming in to destroy the forest under the pretext of a titanium mine.
So far, there's no actual proof that titanium actually exists there, or are there other titanium mines in the area?
There is titanium, but and we've worked extensively. This is part of the work that I do personally, extensively with a very well-known mining research company in Australia. We've sent them the samples of what we found. What it is you go on site in this forest area, and there's a river, and in this riverbed there are some pebbles that are black and shiny that are titanium. So these pebbles are on the surface. We've sent these pebbles to a lab in Australia, and yes, they are 45% ilmenite, which is the component of titanium. Yes, they are 45%. However, one, there aren't very many of these pebbles. And secondly, the processing to separate the 45% ilmenite from the 55% of non-ilmenite is very costly and outweighs the sale cost, which right now has fallen to an all-time low of $100 per ton. So it doesn't make it profitable at all. We've done some drillings by hand. We manufactured some equipment that has to be manned by four workers, and we took it with motorbikes into the forest, and we've actually scoped what's happening underneath, and there's about 80 centimeters to 1 meter of soil with very, very, very small concentration of titanium. And the labs in Australia have said there is such a low concentration that it would not make it profitable to do a mine in this area. However, a really competent and professional company would have to come in and spend at the minimum 6 months, if not 18 months, doing hundreds of drilling and comparing all of the concentrations in each of the drilling holes to what is profitable in terms of processing and sales.
It seems this model of both developing alternative economic scenarios to get away from the slash and burn agriculture and poaching, you know, to create alternatives, combined with your effort to logically present the alternatives as just more economically viable than some of these larger scale developments, where in fact they are more economically viable, is really a unique approach. And I'm wondering how that could be expanded to other countries, or if you've been expanding that to other countries.
If we could receive funding, we really would need to expand to other countries, to Indonesia especially, and to Brazil. Indonesia's forests are going up in smoke as we speak. The Indonesian government has received, I think it's $3 billion by the Norwegian government to stop burning their forests for conversion to agriculture, but nothing has changed. They're still continuing. You can see by satellite photos that entire quadrants of Sumatra Island have been systematically deforested for conversion to other crops. And unfortunately, this is driving the Sumatran tiger out of the forest, and their habitat has shrunk to a point of non-return, and there's not enough habitat left for the tigers. So we urgently need to work in Indonesia. What we've noticed from our model is that Cambodia is really a leader. really a pioneer. They're at the forefront of the ASEAN countries, the only country that has, thanks to us, an anti-wildlife crime unit, that has, thanks to us, really strong law enforcement in the forest and strong forest management planning and implementation. It is a rare example. We've talked to Indonesian government officials. They don't have any of that. They have zero law enforcement. They have a few community members that report on illegal logging, that report on wildlife crimes, and then if they're lucky, they'll have the police come and crack down. But our experience has shown when you find an illegal activity, a crime, you can't wait until somebody else comes to crack down. You've got to crack down right away. So they have no forest crime units, and there's no aerial monitoring. There's no concerted management effort, and that's what we could bring to the table. The Indonesian government challenge is that they have so many different islands, and it's decentralized. Then a central government can hardly intervene in a timely fashion. One of our tools is that we help central government to intervene on local government in a strong and timely fashion. So that's what we would do. We would work with the central government to help them reinstate their power over local government and be the go-between and ensure that that happens. While on the ground, we're helping the local government to set up ranger force. But this of course, costs money.
I was just about to ask, so what are the challenges in doing that?
The main challenge, we have the technical knowledge of how to do this. We have the experience, and we have the team. But what we don't have is the money.
How has Wildlife Alliance been funded over this time? And given, you know, this economic downturn, on the one hand, how can one not do it because the economic development of the country is based on it? On the other hand, you're fighting short-term interests over longer-term goals.
Yes, I think you actually encapsulated that perfectly. It's helping the country develop sustainably against short-term economic gains. And ultimately, we are supporting the economy of the country. Our approach is quite popular, actually, with our donors and on our website, because we are the ones that take the risk to go and provide direct protection to rainforests and wildlife, direct support to government rangers, direct law enforcement to stop shipments, to stop burning, to stop conversion of the forest. On the other hand, because of the economic downturn, it has become almost impossible now to obtain larger pools of money from government like USAID or Asian Development Bank. The new trend is for these agencies to provide money directly to the government. Well, that doesn't work, because if the money is provided directly to the government, then Wildlife Alliance is no longer paid for, and we can no longer be the watchdog, we can no longer be the support in management, we can no longer be the support in law enforcement, we can no longer be the support in developing the economy. How we have most of our funding in the past was through government agencies, and in large part, I have committed my entire funds to supporting our operations from the beginning. Unfortunately, since mid-2008, I have completely run out of funds, and I am only able now to support myself and my daughter's education. Then I have tapped into my mother's foundation, and since 2008, it's my mother's foundation that is almost 80% supporting us. This foundation, unfortunately, in 18 months will be dried out, which means that our model will die with this funding. And I see this as a very bad news because of the successes that we've been able to implement. And I really feel that this model can be replicated in other countries.
Where would you want to replicate it?
Brazil is one of the main targets for our work. It's very similar to Cambodia.
If Wildlife Alliance, say, were funded by the government, would you lose then the independent monitoring type of impact?
Yes, it'd be very different if the government were funding, because it's like this. Why we work in the tropical belt is because there is the majority of the biodiversity on the planet. Why we are assisting developing country governments is because they have the will to protect this biodiversity, but they don't have the funds, nor do they have the competency. So most of these governments welcome organizations like ours. However, in the process of building capacity of the government, there is the whole issue of good governance, which means that corruption and personal interests are often stronger than a sense of government. That means that every single department in every single ministry is ready to take action for their own personal interest rather than for the good of all. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And that's why our role is very important, to keep everybody on the same page, make sure good governance is across departments, and that everybody knows what everybody else is doing. Without a third party like us, it will not happen. And another thing, we have our Wildlife Alliance advisors in each ranger patrol station. We go on patrol with the government rangers every time, everywhere. If we don't do that, we tried it for 3 years, we lose swaths of forest, we lose luxury wood, we lose wildlife shipments every single time.
Basically, you're keeping the system honest by providing that independent eye.
Exactly. We're keeping the system honest. And again, this is also kind of an oddity of how we work. We work with them. So we're not, you know, building capacity so they'll do it on their own. We're building capacity by on-the-job training and coaching, and we do everything with them. So with the rangers, you know, our guys are pulling the wood and pushing the motorbikes through the rivers with them. They're not telling them what to do, they're doing it with them, and I think that's why it works so well. Our agriculture agronomists are working in the field, hands-on with the farmers every day. Our ecotourism guys are there in the village with the villagers every day.
If somebody was interested in learning more about this approach, about Wildlife Alliance, about the titanium mine, where should they go for more information? And also, what can they do to help?
They should go to our website, which is, we're kind of redesigning our website,
and it's
wildlifealliance.org.
Okay.
They should also communicate with our communications officer, John Malloy, and his email is jmaloy, John Malloy, at online, O-N-L-I-N-E, .com, .kh, as in Khmer. Because we have many reports that are not on the internet, and photographs that are available that people can access if they ask for it. How can people help? The main way that people can help is by funding us. So we can continue our work here, and we can replicate it in Indonesia, Thailand, Myanmar, Brazil, before it's too late.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I was very excited to talk with you, Laurel, today. Thank you for this opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about protecting wildlife in Cambodia with Suwana Gauntlett, co-founder and executive director of Wildlife Alliance.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the Animal Wise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.